This is Earth on the Air.
The conversation that we call culture is something that everybody's participating in and creating all the time.
What I feel that a person has to be these days for any information is really a warrior in the sense of going out into the media and going beyond what's there on the surface, looking beneath it.
It is the ancient language of this land. The language has a way of touching people with a feeling that comes from the ancient ages.
During the next 30 minutes on Earth on the Air, we'll be exploring the ecology of media. We'll talk about the alternative media, the role of advocacy journalism, so-called objective journalism, the music industry, people's participation in the media, and we'll close with a special exploration into the basic building block of all communication, storytelling. Stay tuned. According to Webster's, ecology is about the relationship between organisms and their environment. In this edition of Earth on the Air, we look at organisms of communication, the media, and we look at how they relate to their environment, society. But since Earth on the Air didn't come up with this analogy, we should go to the source for a definition of the ecology of media.
The ecology of media is a metaphor and is simply a way of referring to what you might think of as the media ecosystem, the variety of species that are involved, the complexity of them, the way they interact.
Alan Atkison is the editor of In Context, a journal of humane, sustainable culture, winner of the Utney Reader's 1991 Alternative Press Award for coverage of emerging issues. A recent issue was devoted to the ecology of media.
There are a lot of big fish out there, as in any ecosystem. There are species that dominate, or seem to dominate, because they're so much larger than the rest of them. But when you think in ecosystemic terms, you get the idea that the larger species may not be the most important after all in terms of the overall progress and development of the system as a whole. You can think of culture as a huge conversation that's going on, and the media organs that we think of as being media simply have the loudest voices.
We'll come back to Alan Atkison throughout the program, but let's right away bring in a second perspective from a person who's eager to see fundamental changes in the media ecosystem.
Things are moving so quickly and so startlingly and so mind-bogglingly that just the need to continue to bring to people's awareness the peril of the planet, the suffering of the people, the relationship between those two, is critical.
Paul Gorman is the director of environmental programs at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. He co-authored with Ram Dass the book How Can I Help? But his greatest area of media expertise is in the study of the species we call radio. He's hosted a weekly call-in show on New York radio station WBAI for over 20 years.
We need more of a sense of intimacy about the way in which we share information and share our responses to information. There's got to be a sense of family. There's got to be a sense of interrelatedness in our response to these circumstances, in our experience of these circumstances. How does it feel to you? Oh yeah, this is how it feels to me. Oh, what are we going to do, you know, together? So, and radio is a uniquely intimate medium. I mean, people who are listening right now are not in some big theater, you know, they're in their apartments or they're wherever you all are right now, and it's like a neighbor kind of chatting over the fence.
Maybe that's why radio continues to be such an enduring animal. Even within an environment where it's dwarfed by more highly evolved media species, there's almost a sense of participation in radio. Then again, as Alan Atkison points out, the entire media environment seems to be entering a process of democratization.
Definitely media is getting more democratic. There, of course, are the obvious examples of the fax machines that got information out of China and the ways that videotape have made access to media accessible to people. Everything from America's Funniest Home Videos to the videotape that captured the beating of the young black man in Los Angeles. But it's too simplistic to simply say that media is getting more democratic, because at the same time, control of the larger species in the media ecosystem is actually being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands.
The established media confines information and confines opinion.
Paul Gorman.
And so we're given, you know, a narrow band of a spectrum of opinion by, you know, people who are assumed to be experts. I think that in some way or another we have to start either finding out how to do this ourselves or how to get the media to help us organize, to help us act. I mean, in New York City, we use the little radio station I work for, you know, Pacific Station, WBAI. We use that to organize 15,000 people for a housing march in 1988. The radio station became an instrument to organize people. It wasn't just to report the news or to share information. It was the police switchboard of the action. And we had people all over the city all day calling in and reporting, we're out here in Queens doing this, we need four trucks to pick up food and move some homeless folks over to the demonstration, okay, let me hear the... And all went out over the air. So you heard the sound of people organizing. One of the great freedoms that the First Amendment protects is not just the freedom of free speech, but the freedom of rightful assembly. And what I felt we were doing then was using the First Amendment not as free speech, as we always talk about, but as an instrument for assembly. And we defended that, you know, on the grounds of this is First Amendment stuff, you know.
Which raises the question of objectivity.
Alan Atkinson.
Is there objectivity in media? And objectivity as a concept is pretty much in disrepute these days, thanks to the discoveries of modern physicists who are learning that just looking at a system means you're participating in it and changing it. And journalism as a whole, I think, is still suffering from the delusion of separateness that was born in the 1700s in the era of Cartesian philosophy, when we decided we were separate from nature. Now, it was a mistake to think that we could ever be separate from anything. It was maybe a helpful illusion at the time. But what's happening now is more of an awareness that media participates in creating culture. It doesn't simply report on it. And in fact, everybody knows that part of what is being reported on has been created by the media itself. When USA Today goes out and does a poll of its readers and then reports the results of that poll as front page news, it has in fact created its own news. The barriers are very difficult to determine at that point.
While we're on the subject of objectivity, let's take a short break to listen to Earth on the Air's own attempt at balanced journalism. It's time for Just the Facts, Sam, with Samantha Gleason. Sam?
Thanks, Peter. Hello, welcome to Just the Facts, Sam. I am your objective journalist. I know no opinions. I bring you nothing but objective facts. Today's topic is genocide. The singling out of a race or social group for mass killing. It is difficult to agree upon whether genocide is beneficial or detrimental. I'm here to help you figure it out with the pure objectivity of my approach. And to make it easier, I've invited two specialists to present you both sides of the issue. Thank you for being on Just the Facts, Sam, Mr. Adolf Hitler. So you are an advocate of genocide.
Wir wollen jetzt einmal ganz eiskalt und nüchtern die Interessen unseres Volkes verteidigen.
But you do not see it that way, Mr. Harry Truman, do you?
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base.
Well, that's all the time we have. I'm certain we'll never agree on this topic. Thank you both for being here with us today. And for you at home, I hope you have a much better idea now of what to think about the issue of genocide. Join us next time for Just the Facts, Sam. This is Samantha Gleason, your objective journalist.
The average American child watches 5 hours per week of television commercials alone.
Sugar cane is the largest single crop produced in the world. Over 1 billion tons were produced in 1987. Only three New Jersey municipalities had plastic recycling programs at the beginning of 1988. Now, 90 of them do.
There are more than 600 million television sets in the world.
The average American child watches 5 hours per week of television commercials alone.
50 nuclear reactors and 9 nuclear warheads are known to be lying on the ocean floor. The ocean floor is the 6th largest nuclear power after the U.S., USSR, France, the U.K., and China.
By the age of 18, the average American child has been exposed to over 350,000 television commercials.
If fuel efficiency standards in the U.S. were raised by just 1 mile per gallon, 420,000 barrels of oil would be saved every day, twice the amount lost by the Exxon Valdez.
Women hold only 6% of top management jobs in the news media and 25% of mid-management jobs, but they hold 57% of the entry-level positions. Women now outnumber men in journalism schools by 2 to 1.
Scientists have looked at only 10% of all the data sent back to Earth by satellites in orbit. They have closely analyzed no more than 1%.
It's hard to keep up with all of it. Remember something a couple weeks later, I'm not sure where it came from. It's hard to keep up with all of it. Remember something a couple weeks later, I'm not sure where it came from. It's hard to keep up with all of it.
Hopefully somebody out there is doing something about it that knows what's going on. But as far as me, I can't do much. It's a little guy.
The ocean floor is the 6th largest nuclear power after the USSR. The ocean floor
is the 6th largest. That sound collage was put together by Bill Svoboda. The information was cited in the journal In Context. If you want the sources, drop us a card here at Earth on the Air. The preceding piece of satire was written and produced by Seattle French teacher Jean-Paul Bardou. Now, back to our discussion. Let's spend a minute talking about advocacy journalism. Alan Atkison suggests that the term advocacy may apply to a far larger portion of the media ecosystem than we might imagine.
When the New York Times prints a story about how marvelously our weapons of war performed in the Persian Gulf War, it may not be pitched that way, but it is in fact advocacy journalism. It's celebrating the success of a military war machine. Regardless of one's opinion about that there is a position there that is being advocated. And it's probably not realistic to expect that the New York Times would ever say, well, yes, we realize that we are now promoting weapons of war. It behooves the readers and consumers of media to understand that everybody's coming from a particular set of biases and perspectives, and they may be upfront about those and they may not.
Here's a journalist who's definitely upfront about his opinions. Larry Everest writes for such publications as Z Magazine and The Revolutionary Worker. He's a radical, but he insists that the mainstream media carries an equally strong bias. He cites media coverage of the Gulf War as an example.
News people acted like they were part of the Pentagon themselves, talking about, we won a glorious victory today. Our troops did this, that, and the other thing. Wasn't it wonderful what the bombers did? I mean, they were openly cheerleading for this slaughter. No different than the Nazi Ministry of Propaganda, no different than official state media that the United States is so fond of condemning. So from that, I think I draw two conclusions. One, certainly we need to fight to protest that coverage and to force as many news stories and news footage into the mainstream press as we can. But we also have to support the revolutionary press, because the revolutionary press was uncompromising in its exposure of this war. It was uncompromising in its coverage of what the real causes of the war were. It was uncompromising in bringing any news it could.
But this uncompromising position, according to Paul Gorman anyway, can leave so-called advocacy journalists adrift and ignored in the larger media ecosystem.
As I hear the alternate media and read it, I think they're in real trouble. And I think they're in trouble largely for their own fault. People who work there have gotten frozen into old perspectives and old habits of reactivity. Everything America does is wrong, you know. Everything that's big is bad. And it's really an intellectual challenge, you know, to figure out what is the message that is going to move people. In New York City, there are a lot of people who listen to WBAI or used to listen to WBAI, who told me, I stopped listening to WBAI because I got tired of them making me feel guilty all the time, which is really an indictment. Those people didn't feel included by that information. Those people didn't feel a part of that solution. They felt like they were constantly being harangued. And it's not just a failure of analysis. It's not just the problem of the progressive community not really knowing what its message is right now. It's a problem of the attitude towards the audience and a certain kind of disrespect and a certain kind of know-it-all, you know, presumption. And you don't move that people that way. I mean, I would turn it off, and I do turn it off. I can't listen to it, you know, my own station a lot of the time. I hope I'm not guilty of it myself. I probably am sometimes, but at least it's something to work against.
But Alan Atkinson thinks the alternative media's biggest challenge is just what it's always been, money.
In terms of the role of the alternative media, what has been called the alternative media, I simply would say that alternative media are people who have a media organ that has a smaller budget than, say, the New York Times. They should think of themselves as unique little species in the ecosystem with a particular niche to fill.
Filling and holding onto that niche isn't always easy. Big fish do tend to devour little ones. The recording industry is a good example.
There are six multinational conglomerates that control the distribution system of records. There are six companies.
Chris Knob is the president of the Northwest Area Music Association and the station manager of KCMU, a non-commercial variety music station in Seattle.
Six companies that control 95% of what Americans hear. 5% of that pie that's left over is spread out between 600 to 800 independent record companies that are struggling to get their music out through other channels. So people are dissatisfied everywhere. If they go up and down the radio dial trying to find something different, they're punching a lot of buttons these days, trying to find something new and different. And what I feel that a person has to be these days for any information is really a warrior in the sense of being going out into the media and going beyond what's there on the surface, looking beneath it, going to record stores and looking in the bins for stuff that isn't advertised with the big displays, listening to college radio stations, public radio stations, community radio stations. You have to take the initiative, in other words, to go up and dig up this extraordinary vast treasure of music that is available to us, just like you have to do that for the news, for any public affairs interests, for literature, for the arts. You know, those multinational conglomerates we spoke of will respond to a street action, and rap music is a perfect example of that, when the public demands it. They won't take any risks until they feel there's a public demand for something. You create that public demand, you know, going, becoming this media warrior and not a soldier. When I say warrior, there's a big difference between a warrior and a soldier. A soldier follows instructions. A consumer can follow instructions too, go out and buy that product, right? But a warrior goes out there and seeks new lands for a greater cause, for a greater end. And that is to save this culture that we have in our country and to be proud of it and to nourish it.
I prefer not to think of myself as a media consumer.
Alan Atkinson.
I prefer to think of myself as somebody who is absorbing information out of the media stew. Anybody who's doing that needs to be as cautious about what they take into their mind as they would about what they take into their body in terms of food. Is this nutritional? Is this going to poison me? Is this good food or not? And is this something new? And this is something I haven't tasted before. Let me taste this. What we take into our minds is as important to it for us, for our health in the long term, as what we take into our bodies. And news and media information are no different. I mean, you are what you eat, so.
News.
In depth.
Stay tuned.
I'm Ann.
And I'm Sam. Here's what's happening. Dan?
Tragedy.
Ann? Closer to home. Back to you, Sam.
In the arts. Don't go away.
credit problems.
You've got to eat them before they eat you.
Plenty of creamy whipped topping.
Batteries not included.
Welcome back.
Beautiful day.
Nice tie.
Oh, thanks, Anne.
Tell us more, Anne, about what you're going to tell us about later.
Big story. In depth. Coming up. Back to you, Sam.
Thanks, Anne. Around the nation and around the world. Population. Pollution. Poverty. Deficits. Dow Jones.
In Washington.
God bless the United States of America.
Stay tuned.
Which beauty will enter the pageant?
Desires.
Awesome power.
Together, they're deadly.
And now, back to our show.
Around the globe.
In depth.
I'm Sam.
And I'm Ann. Dan?
More on the war.
The people, in reality, have always had wars, and that's the way it has to be. There.
Environmental catastrophe.
Coming up in sports, do you know who won today?
Who?
Stay tuned.
More after this.
Beautiful day.
You're looking sharp.
Great.
Here's Sam with Eyewitness Weather.
Thanks, Ann. Howdy, folks. Some weather, huh? Same tomorrow. Just look out the window.
That's great, Sam. That's good news.
Now, in depth, sports.
Big game, huh?
Oh, really was.
Everybody's excited.
And there you have it.
Keep watching. I'm Dan.
And I'm Ann.
And I'm Sam. And tune in tomorrow.
Terra Infirma is produced in Denver by Paul Clyde and Company and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Next, In Context editor Alan Atkison makes a rather bold claim that fits right into our philosophy here at Earth on the Air. He says, "We're all journalists. That is, all of us who are capable of telling a story."
I came upon an interesting thing the other day. I'd like to do commentary of various kinds, both in print and radio. And I looked up the definition for commentary. And it comes from Latin words meaning to think or to meditate. And part of what popular journalism might be about is to listen to the stories that you're told, think and meditate on them, and then give your commentary about the stories, as well as telling your own about what's happening to you in your life. In a sense, we really are all journalists, and it's true that the roots of journalism are in storytelling. And in fact, story itself is the basic building block of consciousness that's been discovered. Our minds tend to construct reality out of a series of objects doing something. In fact, monkeys think that way. They say, jaguar coming, and that's a story. So story is a basic building block of consciousness. Therefore, it's a basic building block of civilization. We all tell stories. Even in our conversation over coffee at work, we're telling a story. Did you see the article in the paper today about blah, blah, blah? And then we give our own opinion of it, our own spin. In fact, we probably change the story a little bit, and the story spreads. Journalism is very related to rumor. Rumor is probably one of the greatest media organs on the face of the planet. Word of mouth, the grapevine, is far more influential than the New York Times.
Let's hear a story now. We did promise one. From a woman who's made storytelling her life. Mrs. Vi Hilbert, a Skagit elder of the northern Lachutseid of western Washington, teacher, researcher, and most renowned as a teller of ancient stories. Vi Hilbert was declared one of Washington State's living treasures in 1987. We'll hear this remarkable woman tell the Lachutseid signature story in the ancient language. We'll translate it for you in a minute. First, Vi Hilbert introduces the sounds of Lachutseid.
The language has a way of touching people with a feeling. It comes from the ancient ages, because the sound comes from that long, long time ago, when it was the only sound heard between people and among people. It moves everyone who has an opportunity to hear it. Every audience, from the East Coast to London to Hawaii, every audience feels this strange feeling that they cannot explain when they hear the sound of the Lachutseid language. I can't explain it. I will tell you the first story that I tell every audience. It's the Lachutseid signature story called Lady Laos. aslatlia kwasi bis chad. Atya hik a diai. Hui kwe gosiayas. Hui kwe dadaw. Kul e kwe dadaw. Tya hik a kas chekril. Holo udugwijil atya a hoi hoyal a. Shub shub bis chad. Dils hois. That's the end of the 10-line story, and each audience is invited to listen to this story, and then using the philosophy that you have understood from the story, create an original Lady Lao story. That's the responsibility I give to each listener who hears me tell Lady Lao's.
We at Earth on the Air wondered what some of these other Lady Lao's tales would sound like, so we brought a tape recording of Vi Hilbert's rendition to Marshall High School in Seattle.
Shub shub bischad. Dis hois.
So you got a story?
Once upon a time, there was this old lady. She was walking down the street. She needed some help. So she asked these teenager girls to help her walk across the street, and the girls, they started to laugh at her because they didn't know what language she was speaking. And this one other girl, she came up and explained to the girls what this old lady wanted, and the girls then said sorry to her and helped her walk down the street.
Once upon a time, there was a little boy that lived in a peaceful village. One day, some funny-looking people from another land came and killed his parents and took the boy to their country and enslaved him and persisted to keep down his people and the little boy for many generations to come.
Okay, so there's a little boy, and he goes one day to the river and he sees a big salmon. And he leans over and he grabs the salmon's tail, and he swims down the stream with the salmon, and he's never seen again. And then every time that the villagers go to fish in the river, they offer up a prayer to the boy for good fishing.
Once upon a time, there was this old woman walking down the street, and it was raining real hard. He saw a big house, then he walked in, she walked in, and he saw this dude with a big dog. I can't think of anything.
Those students were recorded by Ted Jessen, a landscape artist, and David Fisher, a teacher at Marshall. The interview with Vi Hilbert was recorded by Janice Kane, a student of botany at the University of Washington. You're probably wondering what the literal translation of Lady Laos is. It goes like this. Lady Laos lived there, in a great big house, all by herself. She had no friends or relatives, so she took it and she swept it, this great big house. There was lots of dirt. When she got to the very middle of the house, she got lost. And that was the end of Lady Laos. That's our show. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, it's your program, too. Write Earth on the Air for tape submission guidelines at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. That's Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle 98145. We'd be happy to work with you. We had additional help from Craig McDonald, Susan Gleason, Kathy Bloom, Scott Bergen, and Rob Becker. Music was by David Hines. Production facilities provided by KCMU and Jack Straw Productions in Seattle, as well as KSER in Linwood, Washington. Partial funding was by the New Roadmap Foundation. For Earth on the Air, I'm Peter Maloff.